Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 20th of December, 2016. Today I want to deal with a fact that's bothered me for a long time, and that is that so much of Russian history and philosophy is completely and totally unknown to Westerners, including Western academics, even Western academics specializing in this area. You need to remember that Russian civilization is substantially different from that of the West. And what I mean by substantially is that the terms and concepts that we use in the Anglo-American world can't, generally speaking, be translated into the Russian world and make any sense. The ultimate sign of an amateur in this field is when someone tries to do just that. They'll make reference to liberalism or a neoconservatism and try to apply it to a Russian situation, or you know, Russian history, even worse, pre-18th century Russian history, where Russia, to a great extent, was cut off from the West, for better or for worse. Not entirely so, but very much so. And one person I want to deal with today is Lev Lopatin, who died in 1920, is almost completely ignored in the West. The Russians produced an entire world of philosophical thought that has not been analyzed very well in the West, completely unknown and misunderstood. It's becoming more and more of a problem because we're living in a society now where Russian affairs and politics and thought is now a pop culture topic. And I simply can't watch or read the popular press in trying to deal with these things. The worst part is watching academics pulling down six figures trying to deal with these topics to any great extent. Sound bites don't cut it here. But I want to deal with Leo Lopatin for a bunch of reasons. One is because of his concept of identity, which is so important to much of what we do here. Another reason is I believe he's connected to Alexander Dugin's concept of identity. Thirdly, because he is one of the great fighters against positivism. My doctoral dissertation was on Michael Oakeshott and the language of revolution from his Rationalism in Politics and the Tower of Babel and Experience and its Modes. I was very, very concerned with laying out the best possible criticism and destruction of the positivist mindset that I possibly can, because that's the mentality that we are hardwired into just by virtue of being born in the United States. The Anglo-American world is strictly nominalist. It has a linear view of history and is completely positivist. What I mean by this is simply the notion that knowledge proceeds from induction, that the conclusions that we draw from induction are only valid to the extent that more data can be used to defeat it. Therefore, no truth is really truth. No reality is really reality. And the problem with this is that the number of assumptions that you have to make in order to make that work is too much to make it make sense. Leo Strauss, another writer so radically misunderstood in the West, simply said that reason isn't self-justifying. Reason and logic, these are tools. You can't make an ideology out of them. Lopatin himself said that the assumption that you have to make here is that the structure of our thought on the one hand and the structure of reality on the other hand are completely exhaustive, mutually exhaustive, that they're identical. whatever's left over, somebody can't be arbitrarily cut off. The problem we have is that the positivist mentality in the West says that anything that can't come under our empirical methods is unknowable and nonsensical. Well, from that methodological point of view, I guess it's okay, except that they go the step further and say that it doesn't exist. This is the problem, and it's been a very sneaky way of establishing its complete dominance over people. It's not merely that, well, because this highly dubious method can't establish something, therefore it's of no interest to us. It's another thing then to take the next step and say that whatever is beyond our methods doesn't exist. Now, of course, you know, empiricism is not at the ground of this stuff. Their assumptions, academic and ideological and professional, are at the ground of all of this. Thomas Kuhn's famous Structure of Scientific Revolutions is something every grad student in the social sciences has to read at one point or another. And it's a very good book because it really tears apart the idea that the sciences have any interest in truth or any interest in empirical realities. An ideological set of axioms is imposed on students, and it's called science. And that's true no matter where you go. It's really difficult to avoid. He calls that a paradigm, which is a word that's so overused that it's now meaningless. But it's this ideological set of assumptions that you have to pretty much accept if you want to get through. If you want to get through any program. One thing he doesn't mention, and it is a matter of coercion, and he's not kidding about this. It's a matter of direct coercion. This is how we reach what we consider facts. Positivism and this kind of modern paradigm that Kuhn is talking about is radically relativistic and is only scientific in the sense that if it has some kind of technical application, therefore it's at least useful, if not true. Karl Popper's idea that if, you know, empirical reason brings us to a certain conclusion, we realize that tomorrow a new set of data will come into existence to destroy that conclusion. So truth is simply just what we have so far. But it's far less simple than that. I want to bring up Thomas Kuhn here, which is so important in these discussions, because the central concept is the assumptions and axioms that these people start off with are far more important than the conclusions that they come to. And the conclusions are normally foreordained. So a historian dealing with European history has to accept that the Holocaust of Jews in the Third Reich occurred. That Hitler, in other words, deliberately threw the war. He deliberately lost the war because he was diverting so much fuel and material and manpower to kill a handful more Jews than to fight the Soviets. Now, there's no evidence that that's the case. There's no evidence that anything remotely close to the amount of fuel necessary to burn that many bodies was ever ordered or ever moved or even could be moved, transported at the time safely. It's one of the dumbest conclusions of, you know, of typical wartime propaganda that's now enforced by a code of laws in Western Europe. Now, that's just one kind of silly example, but these are everywhere in academia. They're things that, you know, they're I call them membership words and conclusions. It's about belonging. If you don't accept those things, you will not belong and you will not be promoted. Thomas Kuhn deals with all forms of coercion, but he deliberately avoids one, and that's money. And then the social power that money can buy. In fact, he goes way out of his way to avoid talking about money and that kind of coercion in that book, which says quite a bit about him. It says quite a bit about the people who he's working with and the sort of things that you have to say. Clearly, it's on his mind. He can't ignore it. He knows it's real. He knows it's true. He knows it's corruption. There's nothing he can do about it. He can't talk about it too much, because then, you know, it's one thing to criticize any claim to truth. It's another thing to say that this claim to truth is bought. So Lopatin is, in Russia anyway, the foundation of the criticism against the positivist mentality, this kind of empiricist, really simplistic, baseless assumption of the empirical method, and is a pretty radical idealist. Idealists, in generally speaking, are not, these aren't perfect people from a Christian point of view, but they're absolutely necessary and important to understand, because they destroy the assumptions that underlie materialism. Materialism and nominalism, by the way, are two pretty radical assumptions that positivists make in their system, where they claim that they don't make any assumption. An anomalist can't be a materialist, because materialism is a universal. So these concepts are destructive. They're designed to destroy any connection between God and man, between heaven and earth, or even mind and thought. They're not constructive. Something else, some other ideology, some kind of other sort of set of institutions will come and rebuild that. But this sort of thing is strictly destructive. It's like Marxism. As I've said before on the show, it's very curious to me that Karl Marx never, ever, ever talks about what his future society is going to be about, what it's going to look like, how it's going to be structured. He never says that. He's the only political theorist in the history of political theory that doesn't talk about what his ideal society would look like. He has a few paragraphs at most in all his writings. And so there's a great degree of falsity here. Karl Marx, who claimed to be a positivist, by the way, he claimed to be the fulfillment of the Enlightenment. He is not anti-modern. He is not anti-Enlightenment whatsoever. He considers himself the fulfillment of it. He considers himself to be purely a scientist, he doesn't make any moral claims at all. You can drag some moral claims out of what he writes, but that wasn't his intention. He claimed to be completely amoral and simply stating the facts as his scientific mind had laid them out. Now, we know none of that is true. We know that any of these positivists or nominalists, empiricists, for all of their complaint, whether it be about a lack of foundations or a refusal to deal with any kind of dogmatic assumptions, that they are laden with them. They're laden with assumptions, not just of the ideological and financial kind, but of assumptions that are built right into the method itself. I want to make an announcement here. The bishop who spearheaded the attack on me to get me defrocked back in September, Archbishop Joseph Royer, has died. He died suddenly on the 19th, yesterday. He was only 61. I don't know what the details of this. I've not seen an obituary or anything. It was a very sudden death. And despite what he's done, the damage he caused, I asked my supporters to pray for his soul. He may have been wrong, he may have been misguided, he may have been destructive, but he is not evil. And he deserves to be saved just like any of us. Remember that no one thinks that they're the bad guy. No one thinks that they're doing the wrong thing. At the very, very least, it's rationalized. So pray for his soul, the Archbishop Joseph Royer of Edmonton, Canada. I have no idea what happened there, but it's not something to be pleased with whatsoever. And we pray for his soul, and we should pray for his soul from here on in. Okay, the philosophy of Lopatin is important because what we want to do is lay a groundwork. Really what this show has been about for a long time is laying the groundwork for a critique of modern society through the Russian Orthodox tradition. Russian Orthodox tradition is a critique of modern society. Claiming that Russian Orthodox could be a modern is kind of like saying, an Orangeman in Northern Ireland could be a Catholic. They're defined in such a way that it can't be. It doesn't work. You can mouth the words, but the meanings can't be connected. They're contradictory in their very essence. One of the essential core ideas of the modernist mentality is positivism, the very extreme, almost relativistic, empirical approach to information. That experience under very certain specific conditions, experience within a certain paradigm of thought, which unfortunately they can't avoid, is the only way to get the information necessary for technological advance and progress to any given society. Notice I'm avoiding the word truth because that's not something they believe in. Early on, when people like Francis Bacon, even John Stuart Mill much later, did believe that truth was possible using this method. That's been abandoned. And one of the reasons it's been abandoned is because of people in the West, but in the East, people like Lopatin, who challenge this notion. And they usually challenge it on the grounds that they're assuming too much. The central core in his thinking is that appearances, phenomena, the things that we perceive are never self-grounding. Russian philosophy is deeply focused on the principle of sufficient reason. He believes in substance, with a capital S, in a similar way to Spinoza. Spinoza is a very valuable philosopher, and it's pretty rare that Christians ever even think about the guy. Michael Hoffman and myself have made different times have made the claim that he was a Christian, secretly. And this is a real reason that he was anathematized. One of the things that Spinoza did was to reject the Talmudic attacks on the Christian faith and Christ personally. But when you look at his philosophy centering around the idea of substance, which he calls God, which in and of itself is not a problem because he's approaching God not as a theologian, not as a penitent, but as a metaphysician. Approaching God that way already has certain limitations that are built into it. You can't go beyond that. So approaching God as substance will eliminate any concept of personality. And that's okay, so long as we understand that the method that he's using leads to this. He's not saying that God doesn't have one. It's just that in using my method, that's not important to us. That will be important to other methods, equally valuable. But from a metaphysical standpoint, substance is God. Substance is the primal unity that existed before time existed. Time comes into existence only because that breaks up into what Plato would call the archetypes. Archetypes are the very first principle. You see this in Plotinus as well. The Neo-Platonic movement. Even to this day, fragmentation, you know, the concept of with the Spinoza's attributes were Plato's forms. The idea is these things exist only to the extent that human beings can't grasp substance. Substance with a capital S is normally inconceivable, but it can be described in very, very general terms. But even using both of these methods, substance, it's not a theological concept. It can be in other methods, but this is strictly a philosophical and metaphysical idea. Substance is the core of everything. We can't connect subject and predicate unless there's a third thing that joins them both. Substance manifests itself in what the archetypes all have in common. Be the form of the good, the form of the true, the form of the beautiful, the form of justice. What is it that all of those have in common? And that's our little tiny glimpse into what substance is. The goal, the foundation of all science is metaphysics. Because a positivist can't function without this laundry list of assumptions. And one of those assumptions is that my logical structure that I'm using to analyze reality is in fact out there, rather than being something that we just impose because it's useful or it makes life easier for us. Substance isn't material, and therefore it's completely free. No appearance is ever substantial. So an appearance, a phenomenon, is very far removed from what substance is, but whenever we perceive something, we have to ground it somewhere. It's not an arbitrary set of ideas. Every thought that we have, every bit of cognition, according to reason anyway, implies the spirit and implies freedom. If everything were mechanical cause and effect, there would be no reason to believe that something is true, only that something has come into mind consciousness at one time. The reality, therefore, is completely psychic. One of the most important, I was just asked recently, how do you begin thinking in orthodox terms? And I've answered this question in different ways in the past, because there's more than one starting point. But the one that I like the most is to say that the world is our projection. The sinner, those steeped in passion, who are unredeemed and who don't know how to repent, don't see the world in the same way that we do. The world is greatly distorted because its passion is interfering with not just their senses, but their cognition as well. Passions, which are almost out of control in most of us, are constantly like an addiction. You know, an addict is always, you know, their perception is only about getting more of whatever it is they're addicted to and justifying it to the world. The world is my projection. The ascetic life is absolutely necessary for us to see the world as it actually is. And in fact, the purpose of the ascetic life is to be able to perceive God's creation. And the ultimate goal there is to find logos, or the presence of substance, and not just appearances, but in the patterns that the human psyche is always finding in the natural order. Immanuel Kant was a target of Lopatin for the same reason that he was to Fichte. When I first started grad school, Fichte became a preoccupation of mine, because they refuse to accept this dualism that thought and action exist in two separate realms. And because of that, the existence of that kind of dualism implies relativism. If thought and action are separate, and there is no ground that holds them both together again, then the true and the good are not connected either. And this is a problem. This is a problem that, as soon as Kant died, writers like Fichte began to attack Kant precisely in this area, which is one of the weakest points in his philosophy. Dualism always implies relativism. The monism of someone like Lopatin says that the ideal truth, substance, exists above all. And no matter what we do, and no matter what our field is, no matter what our endeavor is, our uncovering of substance in what we perceive, what we do, is the goal. That's why he can say that substance, or I should say metaphysics, is the goal of all the sciences. This is another problem with induction. We're not really seeing things. Let alone, you know, the motives that we have to pick one question over another to answer. That's bad enough. But what we consider to be data points, we're not seeing the same thing. You know, Michael Oakeshott's argument in Experience and Its Modes is that the poetic mind and the economic mind, for example, don't see the same object in the same way. And so what happens to induction? What happens to positivism if that's the case, or even partly the case? So one of the biggest problems with induction is that both in the questions that we answer, or we try to answer, and what we consider to be evidence, is being interfered with by our dominant desire. And this is why I mentioned Thomas Kuhn. And this is why I answered that person very recently, that getting to the actual reality out there means, in the Orthodox faith, getting rid of this interference, that passions, a filter that passions put between us and the world out there. So the structure of things here is God is substance, the foundation of all foundations. Plato's archetypes, and we see these again only because of our own limitations. We can't even conceive of what substance would be like. We know it exists. We could deduce it. We could deduce it because we do know something about what the forms are like. And so what these forms have in common, we have a little glimpse into what the substance is, that which is behind all thought. What exists that in such a way that logic is even possible? That we can even come to consider that the structure of our minds, the structure of our thought and cognition, that this is identical to how things really are. There always has to be a third thing to connect, and anything that we do, any end that we may have, any goal that we might have, has to be connected with the truth of the matter. What is this third entity? Substance has to exist, or else everything falls apart. The biggest problem we face is passion, because passion is always interfering with this. So on the one hand, our senses can't tell us the truth, because ultimately, truth comes from our inner states. The world is a proof given, but that's not how we perceive it. On the other hand, logic isn't the truth either, because it's too contingent. Logic is contingent on our passionate drives, and the things that Kuhn is talking about, and the foundations that we assume. Not to mention the fact that you can't get away from language. So for all the positivist drivel about trying to be purely exact and absolutely perfectly mathematical, you can't get away from language. When you take even the most strictly positivist statistical course, as I had to do in St. Louis, all the way up to the doctoral level, unfortunately, they will go on and on and on about the mathematical methods, and it sounds very impressive, except you learn that it's dependent on how we, as scholars, define the variables. So now you're back to philosophy again. So it makes nice rhetoric to talk about how strictly mathematical they're being and how objective they must be until the very foundation of it is talked about, and that is, how do we define the variables? What is a borderline? What counts as being a member of a class and what doesn't? Now we're back to philosophy. We're not in the hard sciences anymore. And that's no different from any of the sciences, actually. The empirical world shows us certain patterns. But without a ground, we don't know if those patterns are true. We don't know if those patterns are something that we want to see or that really are out there. Remember, a human person only sees a tiny percentage of existence, a small percentage of the light spectrum where we can see. Because of so many biases and the way we lead our lives, how we eat, how our brain chemistry is affected by our environment, we're seeing a minuscule proportion of what's actually out there. Even mathematics for him. And you find this in Russian philosophy quite a bit with like Losev and others. But mathematics are numbers are abstractions from things. Someone might always say that mathematics gives us absolutely certain results. 2 plus 2 was always going to be 4. There's no getting out of that. The problem there is that the minute you consider what that applies to, or even where the number comes from, it falls apart. What constitutes an individual such that you can have two of them? This has been a huge problem because it's always an abstraction. If a scientist is looking at a tree, for example, he has to separate that from the environment. He has to separate that from the natural history of the region. He has to separate that from his own biases about how ecosystems work, from the soil and everything else. It's an abstraction. If you want to include everything, he really can't, because then you're talking about the entire cosmos. So mathematics, where you come, the idea of 1 plus 1, well, what's the 1? It's always a highly contingent, highly problematic thing. Losky makes one of those brilliant criticisms of nominalism in that the concept is any individual object is, in fact, a universal. If I refer to a tree, I could be talking about its history, its bark, the leaves, the fruit that it may produce, what it contributes to the environment, what it takes from the environment, the nature of the ecosystem that it's absolutely dependent upon, its own natural history, the planet's natural history. All of this has to be taken together. It's not just some brute individual. That is completely arbitrary for any nominalist to say that universals don't exist through any words, when in fact everything they point to, every individual object, is in fact a universal. Mathematics is an abstraction from experience. One of the reasons we know this is because it's too perfect. We realize that thought is never perfect. There's always fuzzy edges. There's always difficulties. Yet mathematics seems, at the elementary level that I know it, seems exceptionally perfect. Numbers are numbers. You can argue with them. Well, that's because they're inventions. That's because they're abstractions from our experience. The minute you apply them to something, all of a sudden it becomes very problematic. When you analyze where a number might come from, and keep in mind that there is an entire symbolic and iconic history to numbers. They're not just brute givens. They're historical products. All of a sudden that vaunted perfection falls apart. They're abstractions that don't really apply to anything because we know this because it's too perfect. The sequence of numbers, the way that we can construct them, is so perfect, it screams to us that it is an invention of human beings rather than something that's actually out there in the world. In other words, the use of numbers in the quantitative sense of the word doesn't give us any new information about anything. Remember when Pythagoras or Plato refers to number, he isn't referring to 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Numbers are icons. Numbers are forms. Principle, for example, of 1 being the unity, 2 being multiplicity, how our fallen state can't see substance, and therefore we could only see separate aspects of it, as Spinoza would call the attributes, and really we'd be calling the modes. The concept of multiplicity isn't just the number 2. The idea there is the fact that we simply can't conceive of the 1. We know that the 1 exists because for there to be multiplicity, there has to be a foundation for it. If you reject that idea, you have to believe that things simply are random occurrences, in which case there is no truth at all. Nietzsche wins, it's only the will to power. But if that's true, the problem with the will to power, of course, is that you might accept it, because it makes you sound radical, except that when it's used against you, you have no right to complain. The problem with the ideological conception of self-interest, egocentrism, the problem with it is that when that ideology is imposed on a society and you are permitted to pursue your own self-interest, well, when you are harmed, damaged by someone more powerful than you pursuing their self-interest, you have no place to stand. You have to tolerate it. You have to accept it. The problem with egocentrism as an ideology, among other things, is that whenever that kind of free market ideology is imposed on a society, like in Russia in 1990-91, there are people who are already powerful. The idea of perfect competition in Adam Smith only works if everyone's the same. It's identical to a state of nature theory. It's a thought experiment only. It's not meant to be imposed on a society. Because at any given time, you have a ruling class that will be able to take advantage of market signals far more effectively than anybody else. So it will be just nothing more than a rationalization of power that will get even greater and greater. People who are able to charge rents, people who have access to the state, access to resources already, then simply use it to further their own power, which is exactly what happened in Russia and Ukraine. And just shows you the stupidity, the arrogance of Harvard University and State Department and American conservatives and liberals who were identical at the time, saying this is what Russia needs. Because they're thinking in these abstract terms, not in terms of reality. They're thinking in ideological terms, not in what's actually out there. If you have the notion of substance, or excuse me, if you reject the notion of substance and simply see phenomenon floating around in some sort of a flux, then even language itself becomes impossible. You could never be certain that the words you're using today will have the same meaning as they do tomorrow. It's one of the most intense intellectual crises of our era, is that vocabulary is always changing. Going back and forth from the conversational sense of something to a professional, technical sense of something makes communication almost impossible. And as people, in intellectuals especially, get more and more vulgar, even their technical use of the vocabulary is becoming worse and worse. They've completely given up defining something like love or justice, being perfectly aware that that's something that they will impose later on. It's nothing more than a rhetorical cover. So what's the point of all this? What's the point of idealism in the first place? The facts of our mental life are designed to challenge the prevailing ideology of the era. That which makes the United States and the Anglo-American imperium, what it is this empirical, or at least semi-empirical, positivistic mentality. It is hardwired. It is extremely difficult to break out of. I don't think any of us could do it with any great thoroughness. And one of the reasons we become hermits and we go, isolate ourselves is because we're trying to break out of this thought process. Hardwiring is just that. It's not just the function of our brains. It's the foundation for the function of our brains. And that's nobody's fault. I can't help it that I was born in 1971 and not in 1071. But all thought, all action, really, our mental life is typified primarily by the desire to find the substantial ground to everything, without doubt and without question. The purpose of our mental life is to manifest the truth. The purpose of language is to manifest the truth. We have to realize that there is an internal unity to everything before there could be multiplicity. The foundation has to exist before we can talk about any of its pieces. The whole has to exist first. This is essential to the Russian intuitivist movement, which is based around the idea that whenever we talk about any individual thing, we have to be cognizant that we are abstracting it from an entire universe, an entire cosmic world that all conspires to make it what it is. Any object, anything, is in fact a unity. Look at a tree, and it's a collection of a lot of different things, from the number of molecules and chemicals that it's made from, and how it functions, what it gives, what it takes, all of this. It's not an object. It's a series of objects. And we call it, so it's automatically a universal. Very elementary criticism, but sometimes it doesn't occur to philosophy professors when they're talking about what nominalism is, what individualism is. The line between our own individuality as people and the influences of the society around us is extremely blurry. Same thing could be said for nations. You can't have meaning, though, without unity. We refer to an object, you have to be just as that and nothing else, nothing more, nothing less. And only then, can we give it a definition. The biggest problem we have in epistemology right now is the fact that language has been completely removed from its referent. It exists in a world totally of its own. Now, if language can create the world, if the world is structured because we define it in a certain way, and we describe it in a certain way, linguistically speaking, that means whoever controls the language controls the nature of reality. Demons used to be called the masters of reality for that reason. They construct the world for those who don't know any better. It's all illusion. Whether it be for the addict, in old definitions of the word addict, whether it be a lust for power or women, money, or some sort of a drug or something like this, the world is simply one a big arena where this stuff can be found and justified and used and competitors squeezed out and our enemies kept at bay and our friends kept closer. That's what the world looks like. That's not what's actually out there. But any disorder imposes itself on to the outside world. That really blows empiricism out of the water. One of the reasons that this is important is that our own selfhood is one of these objects. The famous Cartesian formula goes a lot farther than what even Descartes had understood. People like McClarkus and many others made the argument that the number of deductions that come from the I think, therefore I am a slogan is substantial. One of the things that comes from it is that we know that our consciousness, our selfhood, is a single unity. We have to know that because all of our memories apply to one person. If our consciousness wasn't a single thing, then our memories wouldn't be ours. They would be completely disconnected. They would have no subject. Plus the fact that we recognize ourselves, our understandings of the world, over time. That's proof that consciousness is a single thing. It is a universal, it is a single object, it is spiritual. It's spiritual in the sense that it's not material. Our thoughts, how we perceive things, they don't go by a strictly deterministic mode. We structure those, for better or for worse. If we can do that, it's not totally determined. If it's not totally determined, it can't be material. Therefore, it's the foundation of spiritual life. And we know it immediately, not through concepts. Whenever we make a reference to an object, we're referring to our selfhood on one hand, the object on the other hand. But that's not sufficient. There has to be a third thing that connects us both. Adam and Eve had a conception, a very innocent conception of this substance, this unity from which everything comes from. Sin is typified by the introduction of this fragmentation, that the unity, the intuitive unity, began to be more and more distant, more and more hard to comprehend. I don't believe in evolution, but I do firmly believe in devolution, that the world became more fragmented, people became more isolated from one another. Elements in space and time excluded each other. Material objects, anyway, exclude each other. Animals fear human beings. People fight. People have different motives and desires. They demand that their projection of the world be considered the only true one. The number of neuroses that come into existence as society gets worse and worse and worse over time. Because what was understood intuitively in the garden now is nothing more than a distant memory. And what we have are, you know, words, this attempt to understand things with a meaning that's always changing. And now, apparently, they have no foundation at all except those who have power. You think of words in this respect like we think of currency. Powerful people control money because they're powerful. Money in and of itself doesn't have any value. It has value because there's a system in place that has the power to force it on people and have it considered to be, you know, strictly their property that they print and that they coin and that they are able to hoist on a society and decide on its value. In and of itself, it has no meaning. It's no different in this case. The words that we use are being continually redefined by those who have the power to define them. Breaking out of this cycle, breaking out of this extreme totalitarianism, is something that the Russian Orthodox mentality, especially in the old believer mentality, as Alexander Dugin is putting out all the time, is the ultimate goal. As difficult as all this might sound, I remember distinctly in college, you know, I was losing arguments in like my freshman, sophomore year because I couldn't break out of the mode of thought that the modernists had. And I thought maybe I was the problem. And I realized that, you know, we're hardwired this way. If you're going to critique the modern world, you can't think as a modern. But that means, you know, your life, the way that you live your life is going to be very, very different. Your personality, the way you see things, has to be radically different from the people around you. People around you see the world as dead. The natural order, including other people, are simply tools for our self-interest. If that doesn't define modernity, then nothing does. And you see in John Locke, for example, the essential core of his economics is that the natural world that confronts the ego is completely dead and valueless. It only has value when this mysterious rational capacity that humans have is imposed upon it. Then it creates things. The civilizations that come from the use of reason, only that has value, but nothing in and of itself. Therefore, the only thing that has value at all is human reason, although in an oligarchic society, it's those who control the nature of reality. If you can control the nature of reality through defining words, then you control reason and logic. What's considered logical isn't really what's true. It's what conforms to a set of presuppositions. Now, one of the reasons I go through all of this is because, if you haven't noticed, we're slowly becoming concerned with identity. In 2016, we come to the end of this year. Identity is essential. We live in a society where if you are white, you're not permitted to have an identity. Other races have really a kind of a made-up culture imposed on them by white intellectuals in universities. It doesn't mean they don't actually have one. Certainly not the one that they're learning about in college, though. Whites have none whatsoever, or at least nothing to be proud of. Destroying the identity of people means to destroy their self-esteem. And if their self-esteem, their sense of personhood is destroyed, then they'll be your slaves forever. The ultimate goal is abulia. Abulia is not just this lack of will or lethargy. It is that. But it's a lethargy that comes from the lack of motive. But there is no meaning in the world. There is no purpose to things. And therefore, why should I work other than to stave off starvation? If nothing has any lasting value, nothing can have any lasting or any value if there is no meaning that's inherent in creation. Unfortunately, the modernists can't get away from this problem. If the outside world is dead, something that could only be constructed through human reason, that's really just another way of saying, it's really a mystification. What they mean to say is that those who are powerful enough to hoist their concept of the world onto a whole society, they and they alone, decide what's real. It's the ultimate conception of the will to power. This is why Nietzsche is so extremely important. But the focus of Friedrich Nietzsche is, if you could put together a systematic metaphysics with him, which is hard to do, you have to start off with the idea of the flux. The idea of the flux can be found in the Kabbalah, the Ein Sof, their conception of God, which isn't really anything. It's the very same flux that the elite can then impose their will upon. If there's no substance, then your identity can't be plugged into anything. You have nowhere to stand if your sense of self is taken away from you. Because if there is no stable meaning and there is no substance, there is no foundation, then anything you believe about yourself is equally right or wrong with anything else. Identity politics is about how a powerful group of people, a handful of people who run academia, who run the press, who run the major corporations, and certainly the ad agencies and entertainment, this pagan pantheon of celebrities, is simply how they define it. Beyond that, there isn't anything. You know, the American black identity, for example, is largely the creation of the Time Warner boardroom. They created rap music and you know, certain types of black clothing and behavioral norms and everything else that comes from corporations. Nothing to do with the traditions of blacks in America. Nothing to do with the traditions of blacks in Africa. The very fact that they use the word Africa as if it's a comprehensible thing shows you how absurd it is. The black culture is nothing more than the creation of the Jewish corporate elite. Every bit of it has been hoisted upon them. And this is one of the central ideas of Louis Farrakhan, The Nation of Islam. He has the same problem we do in the sense that he's trying to break out of this fake, artificial imposition of an identity onto a group of people, black people in this case. It doesn't exist. But to say that doesn't mean that they don't have an identity. They do. Now, Alexander Dugin is very useful here. He has three sorts of identity that plug in perfectly with what we're talking about in terms of Lopatin's theory of the self. The first idea is diffused identity. This is a very vague, really insignificant, inchoate sense of self. It, at best, it's symbolic. It has no real impact on how we live our lives. It's sort of like how white people view ethnicity in America. You know, Irishmen really just, you know, they get drunk on St. Patrick's Day. That's pretty much it, though. It has no connection to who they really are. It's diffused identity is a meaningless identity. It's not an identity at all. The second type is the extreme. And this is when we rebel against this and we go too far in the other direction and we seek to impose this strictly rigid ideological conception of who we are onto what we think is this flux of falsity. It's empty. And this is an ideologue. It's a definition of paranoia where the world has to change to conform to our concepts rather than the other way around. It's an excess of reason, of paranoia, an excess of the rational faculty, which is the very definition of panlogism. The idea that there is no distinction between how we think, the structure of our cognition on the one hand, and the external world on the other. They're one and the same thing. You have class identities that are that way, religious identities, even ethnic identities that are so rigid and strict that they are nothing other than a understandable but false extreme reaction to the idea of a diffused identity. The third is the good one. The two bad ones, and the third is a good one. And that is a deep identity in Dugin's thinking. This is legitimate in the sense that it's organic and verifiable. It can't be strictly rigid because nothing in the human world is. You know, the word canon, we talk about the canon laws, The word canon comes from the Egyptian plant. It's a reed that is extremely flexible. It could be bent in any direction, but it can never break. That's what the concept of canon. That's what the concept of canon is. Canon refers to precisely that reed. This is what we're talking about here. It's flexible. It always has fuzzy edges, like everything we do, even numbers. It's the foundation of our thinking. It's the foundation of logic that has a defensible connection to substance. It's substantial in that it holds all our actions together and makes sense out of the society around us completely. The real payoff here is Dugin's conception of what an American is. Using all of these ideas, we find out that the American has no identity. It is pure diffusion. The argument that Dugin makes here is that the American is modern and now postmodern. There was never a non-modern part to America. America didn't become modern. It was actually created that way. The individualism and egocentrism, at least since the 19th century, has been the diffused idea of the American concept. That's not an identity, that's the negation of an identity. Liberalism, liberalism can be considered an identity, as could, you know, cosmopolitanism. Capitalism, these things, they're not as abstract as sometimes I like to think of them. They do have many presuppositions about the world, about morals, about the purpose of our lives. Now, the solutions, you know, really one of three things. Either number one, we can reject this entirely and adopt a more healthy European identity, one of the ethnic groups. We can become Protestants and just make divine this fragmentation that the American life is based on. Or, finally, to focus entirely on egocentrism. And there, Alexander Dugin makes reference to Seraphim Rose. My opinion, my personal opinion, is that we have to take the first one. Seraphim Rose, myself, we have found a home in the Russian Orthodox world. There is no home in the American world because the modern world is an attempt to destroy foundationalism. There are no foundations in modernity. Now, one point of disagreement might be places like the American South, you have a pre-modern English identity there. That may well be possible, but to the extent that there is a cavalier spirit from the English Civil War era, that's very possible. Dugin says that the American Indian does have a pre-modern claim. I think there may be other examples of this, but in general, especially when you're born in the 20th century, we don't have much of a choice. We cannot become egocentrics. We cannot just drown ourselves in this kind of fragmentation. We have no choice but to plug ourselves into a healthy tradition. The United States was founded as a federation, not a nation. It really doesn't have a past. However, the peoples who make it up do have one. And to find an allegiance with a European body in the truth of, in my case, in the truth of the Orthodox faith, you have no choice, but there is no American Orthodoxy. There is no pre-modern America. Therefore, there can't be any American Orthodoxy. Any attempt to make Orthodoxy correspond to American life is disastrous because American life is inherently anti-Christian. We find an ethnic group, a European religious conception. And this is how we come to slowly but surely define ourselves and therefore separate ourselves from the world around us. And this is why Seraphim Rose was always so important to Dugin's thinking about America. This is what he did. You can't have an identity in any real true sense through egocentrism or liberalism. These are identities, all right. They're totalitarian ones, but they're not healthy ones. They have no organic connection. They exist purely as negations. They destroy the self in their claim, rather than, you know, as they claim to empower it. It's a Protestant type that divinizes the idea of American exceptionalism and individualism, has no foundations whatsoever. Protestantism is nominalism. It was the very first time that nominalism became the core of a form of religious or political thinking. And it destroyed any inherent meaning to the world. And what happened? The state took it over. Later on, corporate capital took it over. Luther created strictly authoritarian, unified states with no religious check whatsoever. I mean, without him, without realizing it, of course. But that's what happens when you destroy these intermediaries, which are the universals that we're talking about. A diffusive identity is never real. The artificial extreme one is equally false. Only this organic connection, a real deep identity, but unfortunately, for the most part, is not to be found in the United States. And that's the nature of our struggle. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.